Of mind.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand Demel with you with The Positive Mind. Here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you live a more positively minded life. Fascinated by how they function, and how they function in different situations. For a little while, I worked at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. I was doing my undergraduate work there. And I remember we had an experiment, and the experiment was just simply training mice to run a maze. But another experiment that they did, which was kind of interesting, is they had mice in a 1 foot by 1 foot environment, 12 inches by 12 inches, and they asked the question, what would happen to the mice if you changed it to 11 and a half inches by 12 inches? Took off half an inch from one side. And they found that the mice within that environment became violent, with half an inch missing. You couldn't even perceive this distance. But yet the environment seemed to have a serious effect. In the studio with me today, two people. First, Stephanie Dahmer, of course. Stephanie, you remember the extreme, surviving extreme environments? What was his name, the physician?
Dr. Ken Kamler.
Ken Kamler, right.
Yes.
And remember, what did he say about surviving in extreme conditions? Here's a man who was a physician from Long Island, right? Traveled the world.
Micro-hand surgeon.
Yes. And what did he do?
Well, he was on the mountaintop when the Mount Everest disaster occurred. And he was the only doctor on the scene, and he helped the individuals. I can't remember their names, but everybody knows these stories about this team that went up there. And he saved one of the guys, with the one who had frostbite. So there was a whole thing about surviving that and how this particular man who had this frostbite survived, like days or something like that, several days.
And he, the physician, was attracted to extreme environmental conditions and functioning at that level.
Yeah, he even was in, you know, the Amazon and different other kind of elements as well, environments that were challenging.
And now you're a big fan of watching House.
You like
watching that science, right? And what do you like? And what, because I'm trying to get to where we're going today, which is a very interesting interview with Emily Anthes, who I had promised you, who we had talked to on the radio earlier this week or last week. But here she's in person, here in the studio. And this is a brilliant young writer who has been writing some articles that have been turning our head. But what attracted you from the House program to Emily Anthes?
Well, here's the direct way that I found this article that Emily wrote. In the Psychology Today, we did a show several weeks ago about Marriage and Relationships by Hara Astroff Morano. And so I was reading that article in the Psychology Today issue, and I also saw this terrific article about surviving extreme environments by Emily. And I said, wow, we have to get this woman on air. She's really terrific at explaining things that, you know, most people would not really understand. And in this article that we'll all discuss, Emily describes this one situation where there was a doctor up in the Antarctic who had to give herself a biopsy because she had potentially breast cancer, I suppose. And there was an episode on House, I don't know when because I don't watch the current episodes, where a doctor was up there. She was a psychiatrist up in the Antarctic with another couple of people, and somebody had an accident, and she was the doctor up in the Antarctic, and through teleconferencing, House helped her with the man who had an accident, and then she wound up being ill, and she had to do biopsies and whatnot to herself. So it was really based on this very story and this example that Emily writes.
All right, so Emily, how do you wind up in the Antarctic?
Through
space, which is a sort of a roundabout way to get to the Antarctic.
By the way, welcome to our studio and welcome to WBAI in person.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Your last presence was very welcomed by people. They loved hearing you on the air.
Well, I'm glad to be back.
Yeah,
and
great.
Hopefully we'll have some more interesting things to tell people today.
Sure.
The way I first came across all this research that's been done on people who spend the winter in the Antarctic was through finding an ad for what was called the Mars 500 program, or the Mars 500 project. And I was surfing around online. I found this listing saying volunteers wanted to spend 520 days, which is nearly 2 years, in this isolation chamber. And I thought that was fascinating. I was trying to imagine what would prompt someone to want to give up 2 years of their lives to spend in this isolation chamber. Of course, money is the answer. I think they were decently paid. But what struck me was that this was supposed to be a simulation of the amount of time it would take to get from Earth to Mars, about 520 days. And what NASA was interested in was not the engineering. How do you create a rocket to take you there? There are people at NASA who are working on that sort of stuff. But on how people manage or would manage the psychological stress of being in a small capsule with a few other people for nearly 2 years.
And you're in the capsule alone. You're not in the capsule with a few people.
No, in this
scenario,
I think there were 6 or 7 volunteers they were looking for. They were also from different nations.
Each in their own pods or each in a common pod?
No, they each had their own sleeping bunks, but it was designed to be like a space shuttle. So there would be a common dining room, and there were these narrow wood-paneled halls. It wasn't spacious, which was part of the stress they were looking at, was being in a small space with other people who you couldn't
pick. Kind of like a submarine.
Yes, exactly. And everything about this experiment was designed to simulate the trip to Mars, including a time delay in communications with the outside world, limited contact with friends and family. There were no showers. They had to clean themselves with napkins, all of this stuff. And what interested me was imagining people in these capsules with cameras all over the place, and sitting on the other side of the camera were psychologists. And something about that image just struck me. It's not something I normally think about when I think about the challenges of space. We think about how do we get to Mars, not how will people fare. And so the fact that this elaborate experiment was designed to illuminate the insides of human mental function, I found fascinating. And when I started to dig into it a little more, I found that this is it's a problem scientists have thought a lot about previously. And before they designed these elaborate simulations, they tried to imagine what people would face mentally in space by studying people who went to the Antarctic, which seems different but presents a lot of the same challenges. These people are isolated. During the winter in the Antarctic, because of the environmental conditions, the way the ice freezes over in extreme weather, people can't get home and they can't get in to deliver new supplies. You're in a small space with people you haven't chosen. All these factors make it similar to what you would experience in space. And so psychologists have sort of furiously been studying how people do in these environments to try and see how to prevent disasters or to promote mood or keep cognitive functioning high.
So that led you to inquiry about different environments, right? The different kind of environments. So what have you studied? Tell me. I mean, one of the most fascinating things was in the biosphere in itself, right?
Right.
So what are the different things we learned about it?
So there was this project called Biosphere 2 that was in the 90s, where a group of sort of renegade scientists essentially built this bubble out in the middle of the desert in the U.S. And the project was actually designed to mostly be an ecological project. It was hermetically sealed. They put all these different ecological regions in there. So there were ponds with fish, and they grew crops. And the idea was to see if you could create a self-sustaining environment. They put 8 people inside, supposed to be for 2 years, and see if they could grow their own food and recycle their own waste and do those sorts of environmental tasks. But it ended up being a fascinating psychological laboratory. About halfway through the mission, there was a sort of irreparable rift in the group, and it became 4 against 4. For the final year of the project, the two opposing groups didn't speak to each other. They didn't even look at each other in the eye, except when they were forced to for some mission task. And it really showed how when you're together with people in a small environment and there's no escape, seemingly small fights can lead to huge rifts. I mean, if you think about a day in the office and you're really annoyed at your boss and they make you do something you think is unreasonable and you're stewing, at the end of the day you can go home and vent to your spouse or to your friends and sort of take a break, watch a movie, sleep on it. In these places, there's no escape. There's no way to vent that frustration or to get away from it and take a breather. And so it can really start to wear on you.
Well, maybe in these environments, you have no way to get away from showing it. And maybe in your office, you wind up with the same kind of division, the same kind of resentment, the same kind of stuff, except you don't have to show it because you get away and you can go kick the cat. You know what I mean?
Right, and you don't have to eat 3 meals a day with the people who are bugging you.
Right, you're not face-to-face with them, but you may still have the same animosity. And it may be just natural that if people are in an environment for a period of time, they divvy up sides. You know, they become the good guys and the bad guys and so on and so forth. Are you saying that the enclosed environment creates more animosity because it's enclosed?
Well, I think it's two things. I think there can be situations in which it creates more animosity. Something that's been a cause of fights in these places is simple things like food. Like in the closets or in the pantries in Antarctica, the fresh fruit doesn't last through the whole winter. So they keep things like bananas and fresh fruit in specially locked closets. And there are a lot of fights over food. Is someone taking more than their shares of bananas? And that wouldn't happen in an office where you're not faced with shortages and rationing and things like that. But at the same time, once you have fights in these places, I think what happens is they're more likely to boil over because there are fewer ways to release stress. Even something like recreation, which you'd think you'd be able to do in the winter in Antarctica. I talked to a doctor who spent more than a year there, and people who are attracted to those places love being outdoors and doing adventurous things. When it gets so cold and so dark, you're really cooped up. He said a few times he went out, managed in the dark to go skiing a little bit, and that really, he could tell a difference. It boosted his mood, but there are very few even recreational outlets like that.
And it's kind of fascinating. You know, part of the reason that the northern countries even exist, the northern populations even exist, was because originally, I believe, as we migrated out of Africa, we went searching north, but we thought north is a good idea, except north is no good. There's not enough food. But we learned how to preserve food. And since it was up in the north where ice was, that preservation of food was learned. It winds up being one of the things they fight about the most,
right?
The unpreserved food. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, give me that. It's kind of fascinating that we have some kind of primal root that takes over. What else have we learned about the shortness of the light? Now, I always thought that the shortness of the light spectrum results in people being depressed, but I could never find the true chemical connection. Could you tell me what you found?
Well, the interesting thing is that psychologists have known for a while that there's a connection between light and mood.
Yes.
When you hear things like seasonal affective disorder and people get depressed in the winter, and that light can rectify this. You hear about places in the northern countries where there's light cafes and people go and lie down in basically a tanning bed to get their daily dose of
and
light.
And people buy little machines that you put in front of your face.
Right, exactly.
To get light because you're figuring the light is doing something.
And that connection has been well established, and it's something that's obviously at play in the Antarctic. I mean, you have literally months of darkness with not a speck of daylight there. What researchers are also uncovering, though, is that temperature plays a role, that the cold itself could be wreaking havoc on mood. And what they think is happening is there's a gland in your neck called the thyroid gland. It releases hormones, which we talked about in our last program. And some of these hormones are involved in regulating your body temperature. They're also involved in the brain and just keeping the gears running smoothly. And when you're cold chronically, not just for an hour because you step out to wait for a taxi, but for days and days and days, all of these hormones get recruited to keep your body warm. And they get sent away from the brain and to the body. And so basically what happens is the gears in your brain that require these hormones stop running so smoothly. And so that can cause declines in mood, problems in cognitive functioning, just because the hormones that normally fuel the brain are being used just to keep your body together.
I was reading some research about the military who get sent into climates like this, like when the Germans invaded Russia. And they're in these planes, or when we were in different places, and you have people, soldiers, exposed to ice-cold weather, and they're not used to it for long periods of time. And the depression and the possible suicide that happens as a result of it.
Right.
So what we're saying here is that it is not the light, but the cold that may be leading to, the cold may be leading to an effect on the thyroid, and the thyroid may be the very thing that's creating the problem.
Well, I think it's probably both, and it's probably been lumped together throughout a lot of studies. I mean, if you think about the places where it gets dark for many months, it's also winter and it's also cold. And so I think maybe these effects have been lumped together and scientists are just starting to tease them out.
I wonder what the opposite would be. Imagine being like in Los Angeles or in a place where the light is there all the time.
They studied women that are always dressed in the burqas in the Middle East where it's warm, but they're still vitamin D deficient, and that's the key. The sunlight provides the vitamin D, which produces the serotonin and those neurotransmitters. So it's light as well as cold, because, again, in warm environments, people are still depressed and have vitamin D deficiency if they do not get direct sunlight.
But what if you have light and you're, you know, in on an island and you have light all the time and you don't wear a burqa and it's never cold?
Well, we know that many people could have other things too, obviously.
A different imbalance, because
maybe it's too much. Is
yeah,
that what
that's
you're
what
saying?
I'm asking. I'm asking, that's, do we know anything about the other side of it?
The heat and the intense sun heat.
Because you would think your body would have to regulate, I mean, your body has to regulate temperature in the other direction as well. If it's too hot, your body has to do things to cool off. I don't think we've looked at how that might be directing resources away from your mind or your brain.
In extreme environments, different extreme environments that you've talked about, what happens socially? What happens in relationships?
Well, a couple different things. I mean, the first thing that people think about is most of the time you're away from your friends and family and loved ones. You don't have this normal group of peers and support that you might have if you were at home. But at the same time, you have these other people that you're thrown together with, who you may or may not know, who you may or may not ever decide you would hang out with in the real world. And a couple different things can happen that can create enormous stress if your personalities don't mesh well. But at the same time, great relationships can be forged in these environments. Some people who spend 8 months in the Antarctic come out with some of the best friends of their lives because they've survived this adversity together. They've been forced to bond and band together as a team. So it can really go either way, either extremely positive relationships or extremely negative
ones. Like the chess player.
Right.
Tell the story about the chess player.
There have been some famous attacks in Antarctica, people just snapping. Sometimes it's called polar madness. And it really illustrates how a little thing, a little quirk that might just be annoying if someone's doing it one cubicle over from you, can just become maddening if it's someone you're living with for 2 years. And so this happened in one of the Russian Antarctic stations. People who spend the winter there come up with all sorts of diversions and ways to pass the time, cards and things like that. And something that was popular in the station was chess. And so there were two colleagues down there who passed much of the winter playing chess. They would trade moves back and forth. And one of the players sort of got a reputation for being very slow and contemplative with his moves. He would take way too long. I guess they weren't playing speed chess, which would have alleviated the problem. And this sort of wore down his opponent, who got more and more annoyed at the amount of time he was taking to make his moves. And one day he just snapped and I guess what you would call an overreaction, hacked his opponent to death with an axe. And it's just one example. There are a couple others of brutal physical attacks. And these people aren't bad people. They probably wouldn't snap in a normal environment, but these stresses just accumulate and wear on them.
What about the stress of isolation now? You've studied isolation as well, or part of what you were talking about was isolation, individual isolation.
Right.
What does that do to people?
I mean, humans are social creatures. We've evolved as an extraordinarily social species, and when people don't have rewarding interpersonal interactions, mood plummets, cognitive functioning even plummets, and there are people constantly around you in this, for instance, in the Antarctic base, but in talking to people who have spent time there, in the beginning of the 8-month winter, people might be really social and friendly, but as the winter wears on, they start retreating into their own rooms. And it's sort of a chicken and an egg problem. They partly do this because their mood is low and they don't feel like socializing. But then when they retreat and withdraw from their peers, the mood gets lower and it just sort of feeds on itself and can create profound sense of despair or hopelessness.
So isolation itself, which many people I know recommend as a cure, isolation itself for many people could trigger some major reactions, negative reactions.
Right, and I think it depends. I mean, I think if you're living in New York City and you're surrounded by people all the time and you want to go spend 2 days in the woods by yourself, that might be restorative. When you're talking about 8 months on end, isolating yourself from the 20 people who are around you, it might have a different effect.
Well, when you think about one of the greatest punishments in the prison for people who are acting up is to put them in isolation.
Right.
Now, what happens in isolation, Emily? We're speaking with Emily Anthes, who wrote about extreme environments and their effect on people. What happens in a place where somebody is isolated? What happens? What's the mechanism that leads to people very often cracking? What is it? Do they have a loss of sense of time? What happens?
The loss of sense of time is a big one, especially if you look at isolation in prison systems. They combine a lot of the factors we're talking about. So they're by themselves, yes, but they also might be in the dark. They're experiencing something that researchers talk about called sensory deprivation. So not only are they not with people and they can't see, but there might not be very many smells, not many sounds. And our brain is designed to sort of deal with this constant sensory bombardment. And if you go without it for too long, it can be profoundly disorienting. Sort of one of the most consistent things that people report about being in isolation is that time passes, or seems to pass, extremely slowly. So what they'll think is a day has been 2 hours. And so when you're put in isolation for 30 days, it might feel like you're there for 6 months. And that can just contribute to this disorientation and this sense of hopelessness, the sense that this is never going to end. It can really be profoundly unsettling.
Back in the 80s, I remember there were a thing that used to have here in New York called isolation tanks. And what you would do, and we had boxes that were built that way too, you would pay a certain amount of time to go into a place where you had sensory deprivation. You could feel nothing, see nothing, smell nothing, and you would just be isolated. And I remember it being some of the most dramatic, peaceful, fantastic feelings that I ever had. But of course, during that period of time, my mind was leaving. You know, I was no longer, I could even not even be aware that I was an Armand. I knew I was part of something. So imagine what that would be like if that went on for a long period of time, because after a while the bell went off and they said, your time is up, put in another quarter, you know, or whatever it was to do. So that isolation can trigger ecstatic feelings.
Right.
But then beyond ecstasy, there could be the crack.
Right. And I think, you know, it's totally a matter of circumstance and degree. So one of the things we talk about is this sort of sensory deprivation can be really good for people, assuming that it has an end point, that you know that you're going to do this for 2 hours and then you're going to go back to your day, and also that you're in control of it, which is true in these tanks. But some of these researchers have done exactly what you're talking about. Often today, these are called sensory depriving tanks or environments are actually filled with water.
And
what they do,
right,
is put Epsom salts in the water, so it actually makes you float.
I've been there.
So in addition to, you know, not hearing or seeing anything, it even eliminates the feeling of gravity. It simulates weightlessness. And people have feelings, just as you mentioned, of intense relaxation, euphoria. It's been shown to be incredibly effective for people who want to quit smoking. If you go in these tanks and you're asked to think about your goals, people come out and feel totally restored. One of the anecdotes in the piece is there was a Zen master who went into one of these tanks. This is a guy who spends his days meditating, and he came out of a couple hours in the tank and said he only rarely achieves such a state of relaxation. So in small degrees and by choice, it can be a great thing.
Anytime you remove your own senses, which is very possible. I remember going to a place in France where they blindfolded us and you couldn't see. Everything was pitch black, and you went into a restaurant, and which was a pitch black restaurant, and everybody served you, and you just, we weren't blindfolded, it was just everything was dark. You couldn't see anything. And it was fascinating not having my vision. And I think there are people who, there's a friend of mine, Dieter, in Germany, in Italy, who does workshops with people where everybody is silent. He takes away speech. And he says, see what it's like to be silent for a week. Don't speak for a week.
Sounds
and you
hard.
Learn all, it's amazing what happens to your mind when you're not speaking. You could see people, you could greet people, but there's no writing letters. And he said, it's just amazing how different parts of you unfold. So each of our senses, when they're deprived, open up avenues to the other senses, but also could take away some of our major defenses.
Right. I think the problem is, you know, in extreme situations or for long periods of time, the euphoria sort of gives way to madness.
Emily, what was the results of anybody having substance abuse problems in these settings? Did you come up with any information about that? I mean, you would think people would use substances more to alleviate some of these feelings.
I didn't come across a lot on that. And one thing I should say is that people, in order to be able to spend the winter in Antarctica or to go on one of these long trips in space, there's rigorous psychological screening. So people who may have substance abuse problems already or seem prone to depression or any of that sort of thing are generally not accepted into these kinds of programs. That sort of makes it all the more remarkable that if you're screening out all these people at risk for depression, that you're still finding so many people get depressed. And I know there is that liquor, like food, can sometimes become preciously guarded down there and something that's really valuable. I didn't find a lot of evidence of people talking about substance abuse problems, which leads me to think it's not a major concern down there, but I'm sure that it's a way people cope.
My guest is Emily Anthes. We're going to be taking a short break, and when we come back, we'll play a little music.
Mentally
Music from Iceland, Trunol, and Thomas Anderson is playing the bass. He's imported some Cuban rhythms and got some Icelandic singers, and it's kind of remarkable stuff. Stephanie Dambra and our guest, Emily Anthes.
Emily, I wanted to ask you about this whole concept of how they construct the teams and what happens when you put men and women together versus just having an all-male group.
I'm sorry, I didn't say what we're talking about. We're talking about environments, if you just tuned in, my friends. We're talking about extreme environments, and we're talking about being in extreme environments. And the question, and Emily Anthes has written an article in Psychology Today about extreme environments and how they affect people and what she studied. So that's what your question is relative to. Thank you.
Well, the question of building ideal working teams is of huge interest to anyone that organizes these trips to space or Antarctica, because a dysfunctional team can have such disastrous consequences. And so something that researchers have studied, is, among other things, is how multi-gendered teams work in these environments. And just for social reasons, most of the teams in the early days of exploration were all male. And researchers have been contrasting some of these teams to modern teams, which have some women on them. And it may not surprise anyone who has been to a fraternity to discover that the all-male teams work well together, but sometimes a little feeling of chaos can reign, that the men are, one researcher I think called it an animal house environment. Sometimes they're not so clean, sometimes they're not so respectful or polite. And if you bring a woman in, it can have this sort of civilizing effect, whereas the men start using fewer swear words, maybe they drink less, maybe they, you know, pick up around themselves a little more. And there are more subtle shifts, too. Researchers have found that all male teams can be highly competitive. And if you add some women to the team, it gets to be a slightly more cooperative group, that women have that sort of interpersonal dynamic that can foster communication and cooperation. The caveat in all this is the idea of sexual, or the possibility of sexual harassment, which, of course, is a big concern and has happened occasionally in space or in these simulations. And so something that researchers recommend, for instance, is if you have a team of eight people, put two women on it. Don't just put one. Most people don't recommend that you have a single woman or a lone woman. But these mixed-gendered teams can really be an asset. They not only might work better together, but also it brings in different styles of thinking that men and women sometimes have. So they might be better equipped to solve problems that crop up.
You know, and contributing to that harassment could be the fact that people are a little out of their minds.
Of course.
You know, that people are a little wacky, and not only the men, but the women.
Of course.
In isolation could get a little wacky and trigger things.
Especially if they're away from their sexual partners for 2 years. You can imagine that it's, you know, a ticking time bomb.
Yeah. And what about this whole idea of how do you pick a leader? Are there leaders for these environments, and do they have to have gone through this whole process before in order to be able to guide people in this whole experience?
There usually are leaders. These environments in particular, Antarctica and space and submarines, often have sort of a rigid military-like structure. So it's usually not a leader who emerges, but someone is sort of appointed at the beginning. And leadership can make a big difference. There have been a lot of studies on what makes a good leader. And interestingly, scientists now think it's two totally different styles of leadership that are important. The first is sort of what they call a task role. This kind of leader is someone who at the beginning says, you set up the tents, you go find food, you find water, and gives everyone specific roles. And this kind of leader is really important at the beginning of a mission to get everyone established in their duties and their roles. But once things get going and sort of in the swing of things, the best leaders know how to transition into what's called a support role. They don't take the reins so much. They let people do their own thing. They say, I'm here for you if you have problems. If anything happens, bring it to me. How's everything going? Are you doing okay? And then if an emergency arises, this leader can switch right back into their task role and direct people how to do things. And the best leaders really know how to oscillate between these two kinds of roles.
It sounds like being a good parent.
Yeah, probably.
You know, it sounds like what you've got to do as a parent. You know, at the beginning you tell your kid, no, you got to go to the bathroom and you have to do this and you have to do that. And then after a while you lay off and say, when you need me, come to me.
Right. I mean, in this, some of these lessons, like this lesson about leadership, applies in a corporation too. You have to know when to be direct and to give directions and when to ease off and give people some freedom to do things on their own.
Okay. And what about this whole idea of boredom? That was an interesting part of your article about how do people cope for long periods of time with boredom? Is there some benefits to boredom?
There are. That ties back a little bit to what we're talking about in terms of the isolation tanks. I mean, some of the reduction of sensory stimuli, the fact that, you know, you don't have to get up every day and go to the grocery store, that you have don't have sort of all the minutiae of daily life sort of knocking down your door all the time. That can be relaxing. Actually, a lot of people who do best in Antarctica are the people who have some project or hobby they want to work on there. So one of the reasons they might like going is because they have a novel they're working on, or they have a dozen books they want to read. So it's important that someone have something to do in those downtimes, and often people seek out Antarctica and say the reason they want to go back is because it gives them this time to work on this hobby or the other.
Well, it's interesting that hobbyists are usually inward type of people anyway, and they tend to be isolationists anyway. So somebody who is a hobbyist, you know, somebody who's a collector of things, usually lives pretty much on their own, and they have a their social relationships are secondary. They're not that important. You want people to be on the outside, but being alone is a precious thing to you. So I think we can't say how everybody would be affected, because I think people are affected differently. The social type of people give them isolation and they may go crazy.
Well, one of the most interesting things I learned was that these experts and these researchers told me that the people who are most likely to volunteer for these sorts of experiences are the exactly wrong people who should be going. That you often get these thrill seekers, these daredevils, these people who want adventure and stimulation for reasons you can imagine. They want to have these grand adventures in space or Antarctica. And yet these people who need lots of stimulation and lots of adventure are often ill-suited for these environments, which are extremely restrictive and don't, you know, they're an adventure in some way, but it's not like they're going out ice fishing every day. They're stuck in this base.
Well, what about you? Would you go?
I would love to go to Antarctica. I don't know if
You're a writer.
Right. I don't know if I could spend the 8-month winter there. It's actually, these stations in the winter have a couple hundred people. In the summer, Antarctica is kind of, people call it a party. There might be 1,000 people in the station. It's daylight all the time. It sounds kind of fun. I don't know if I'd be ready for the winter.
How about a trip to the moon? Would you take a trip to Mars? Mars, not the moon.
I don't know. It'd be hard to pass that up. You know, not a lot of people get to do that, but you know, 3-4 years away from life on Earth, that would be tough.
So, Emily, there it is, right? There it is. You being one of the people who find it tempting and attractive, but you're not really sure. So I'm going to take it back to what I think it relates to, which is the way a person grows up in a family. Did you have a family, or were you like the only child?
I have a sister, but I'm an extreme introvert. I work at home.
Exactly.
I have no problem going 5 days without speaking to anyone. I think I would probably do just fine in one of these environments. It's not all that unlike freelance writing.
Well, was it like childhood? See, that's the question. Is the isolation, not isolation, but is the separation like a place you found comfort in when you were alone as a kid?
I don't know about that.
Because I'm wondering about how many people find the same kind of comfort that they found as children. You know, it's like when I was a kid, if I could find aloneness, if that's where my safety went, then sure, aloneness is appealing. But if I was a kid and I needed to be with my friends, that's a whole different thing. Do you think of a correlation with that?
Yeah, I mean, that sort of basic introversion, extroversion, I think, emerges really early, and it has a lot to do with how people end up doing in these environments.
Hmm. Did you want to say something?
Well, I was thinking about the idea of having a hobby. It just was making me think, why would that help a person? And if you can do a project or have such focus, you're again changing up your chemistry in your brain, and you're stimulating yourself and you're feeling good. So that alone probably increases the dopamine and does a lot of good things, so that you're not looking for that sense of well-being from another person, where, you know, all this connectedness and these lovely feelings can come from relating to people. But when you have a passion and you have an interest, you could do that for hours, and you could pass the time without even thinking, and you're doing the good things for your brain as well as your body, I imagine.
And I think it really even just changes how you view the time. Instead of looking at a calendar and saying, oh God, 87 more days till I can get out of here, if you can view it as, I've got another 87 days to myself to work on this thing that I'm really interested in, and I've, you know, can get a lot of my novel done in those 87 days. It just changes your whole attitude.
But I think, Stephanie, you make a very, very important point about how we want to adjust our neurochemistry. We like to make our brains feel, give us the right neurochemicals and hormones, and we adjust ourselves all the time. Some people do it through thrill-seeking. Other people do it by isolation and quiet. And one of the things you're saying is that there are two kinds of people. There's always two kinds of people in my book. The people who get their chemistry adjusted by other people and interaction with other people, and it could be direct, it could be like romance. Like in romance, you could feel things that you could never feel otherwise because it's the other person is triggering them. If it's a love sexual relationship, you're having experiences that you really can't have by yourself, right? That's one level. But another person can find that they could do just as well by themselves, that their hobby becomes their love person, that they could do that. So I think, Stephanie, what you're saying is kind of brilliant. There are more than just one kind of person. It's not just the person, everybody needs relationships, or everybody needs to find time alone. It's that different people adjust their own neurochemistry to a point where they could feel safer inside. Now, I'm going to go to this word safety, because I think that's what it's about. I think what we ultimately look for is not thrill, not just excitement, but a kind of level of safety. Where do you feel okay? Okay, the big word. Not nervous, not depressed, but where do you find that okayness of self? And for some people, like you're saying, Emily, it could be in total isolation. You know, in other people, it could be in a love relationship with a family. Have they taken people who have been part of big families and moved them part of the Antarctic kind of thing and taking them away from their families? Is there a major effect if you have a family of your own that you're leaving?
I'm sure that people who have big families have gone. I don't know if they've isolated out the effects. I know, and this just happened last fall, that there have been astronauts who have been in space, dads whose children have been born while they've been gone, and that's been hard for them and their partners that are left on Earth. I know also that some of the people who do best in Antarctica, for instance, are people who go with their spouses. That's not, doesn't happen all the time, but it's not entirely uncommon.
You go with your spouse.
Right, that they'll both be scientists or they'll both be doctors and they'll go together. And, you know, that's, you bring your social support with you. That can be great.
That sounds kind of marvelous.
Yeah.
That sounds
vacation
like,
from the world.
Well, it could be the best of all worlds, but again, if you're one of those people who like to be alone, it could be the worst of all worlds.
Well, you better like spending a lot of time with your spouse, because if you have little things that irritate you and spats, I mean, it could blow up into something bad.
Or if you're just somebody who needs your space alone sometimes. You know, whether they irritate you or not, sometimes you just got to be off on your own.
And I think that occurs both in those kind of extreme environments and here in everyday life. I think it's the same that we face. Maybe it just gets accelerated when you're in an extreme environment, but these are issues that I think are always kind of a conundrum for people everywhere.
The extreme environments that you've studied have a lot to do with atmosphere, weather, and different places. But, you know, extreme environments could be extreme environments of fear. Like, for example, when 9/11 happened, we had an extreme environment and people behaved differently. Wherever fear is very present, wherever people are being very cautious, wherever people are being distrustful, we've also had some very severe winters, you know, and some very severe temperatures here. And you can see that people are different. People are different, and they're all reacting differently. Where do you, if you could, would you talk about the heat environment? Or what would it be to be with extreme heat? You know, like, I'm really curious. If the extreme cold could create such chaos, what do you think the extreme heat creates?
You know, I don't know a lot about that, and it definitely has not been as well studied. I'm sure there's some work out there that I'm not familiar with, but I guess because a lot of scientists are interested in these isolated people who are taken out of their element, and I don't think there are, you know, as many stations in the middle of the desert where people have to spend 6 months in isolation as there are at the poles. And so I think one of the great things about these stations in Antarctica is people aren't going there to be part of psychology experiments. They're going there for other reasons, and it happens to just be a natural laboratory for psychologists. I'm not sure the same natural laboratories exist in deserts. I'm sure there are some, but I don't think it's as easy to study.
Well, there are places where the weather is kind of warm and people don't have to wear many clothing and they don't have to worry very much, like, you know, the island of Jamaica. It doesn't seem to be a highly tense place to be. You know, people seem to be a little easier, more relaxed, you know, cool running and that kind of stuff, you know, is more of that nature. It does seem in the northern climate we have much more pressure than we do in the southern climate.
Well,
you know, the emotional pressure.
I think statistically there's higher depression and alcoholism in the northern regions
and
of the world.
And there we go to that,
world.
Sure.
So that is a little interesting, too.
So part of what we get is by being this highly developed people who can now preserve food, we now get drunk and kill ourselves.
Well, there have been studies that connect warmer climates with more violence and show that, I mean, suicide is different, but that, you know, even just things like, so you see a lot more violence in New York in the summer. People are out more. In the winter, people are less likely to, you know, go get in fights on the street. And it's controversial. Not all research bears this out. But
I don't think that's warmer climates. I think that's warmer.
No, but it is also warmer climates.
In warmer climates.
Right.
I mean,
right.
In places where there are hotter climates, there is more violence.
Some studies have shown that. It's still controversial. But, I mean, I think, you know, whether And climate certainly has an effect on behavior, but those effects are really complicated to tease out because, you know, how much of it is the weather in Jamaica versus the Jamaican culture as opposed to the Finnish culture. It's hard to tease those things apart.
Well, you're going to have to do the research for us. This is Emily Anthes. And Emily Anthes has got her own website where you can see some of her articles, Emily Anthes, ANTHES.com. It has been an absolute pleasure having you here and reading your articles, and I'm looking forward to every contribution you have. Send us advance copies, and we'll schedule you on the air as soon as you come up with something new that you're studying.
Have
one particular area that you're looking to come up with?
I just follow whatever fascinates me. I'm fascinated by the brain and the mind, and I'll read something, and a little sentence will stick out, and I'll want to find out more about it. I'm looking for my next big idea. So
a curious person.
Yes.
Thank you very much for being with us. Thank you, Stephanie, for helping us as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Emily.
And we will be back with you, my friends, Tuesday at 1 p.m. Stay with us.
Because my shoes refuse to ever grow weary.